Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast, bridging the gap between Jewish leaders and those who follow them. Gain insight from Jewish professionals who make the decisions that influence your Jewish world.
Welcome to It's Who You Know, the podcast. This is your host, Michelle W. Malkin, and I am in conversation today with Gila Block, who is the executive director of Yesh Tikva, a Jewish fertility network. And I got connected with Gila through two organizations, Slingshot Fund and Upstart, who were looking to bring people interested in board service to some of the projects that have been through Upstart's accelerator program for board members, for people who are willing to support these startups. And I had read a study that was put out by Leading Edge on CEOs and their experience. And it was very clear to me that board service was one of the things that made a CEO more effective in their role. So I signed up for this program between Upstart and Upstart and Slingshot. There we go. A lot of words to remember. And was luckily, you know, matched with Gila and Yesh Tikva. I was really impressed with their materials and, you know, clearly was presented very well and had a really wonderful professional behind the scenes. And so, so thankfully Gila and her partners welcomed me onto their board. And it's been very awesome to work with her. And I thought it was perfect person to bring on because I will be talking to, Aaron Dorfman in a couple of weeks about a project that he started up, but he started it up a little bit differently than I think you probably got started up. So I'm excited to hear about your journey and experiences in creating something new and not, you know, something that, you know, there are others that do it, but creating something new and wanting to do it better than anyone else is able to offer. So welcome to the program, Gila.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here and so grateful that you joined our board. It definitely has been our greatest honor to have you join.
Well, it's a long commitment that I'm excited to see how things go, you know, moving forward. But so let's just start with you and your story and how you found yourself in this particular position within the organization.
Yeah, my story actually goes back a bunch of years. My husband and I were diagnosed with unexplained infertility, and with 3 years of treatment and no baby in sight, I hit my rock bottom and was surrounded by so many individuals who seemed to be popping out babies faster than I could get back to the doctor's office to do another cycle. And I try to find an organization that could offer me emotional support through this journey and meet with others who were experiencing something similar. And without success, I decided that we should start a little support group around my dining room table because I needed the help. And from there stemmed the beginning of connecting with others who had also experiences in past or who had worked within the fertility community and saw a need for it. And we started brainstorming and realized that if we needed it or for some of them, their patients needed it and it wasn't existing, that an organization like this should exist to help support those in struggle. And so a little support group of three women became the beginning of a national organization to provide emotional support and education around infertility.
Awesome. So how long was it from that first meeting to like signing the 501c3 papers and it's official?
It took about a year.
Okay.
A couple lawyers, really incredibly, we were, my husband's uncle connected us with the pro bono department. Nice. Within his law firm. So we got an incredible team of lawyers who helped us form as a 501c3. It is a grueling process, 501c3, and definitely something that you need a lot of support in the process. So it took us about a year, to incorporate and to then become a, official 501c3. But in the meantime, we started offering support to those we knew who needed the support. And from there grew. In January of 2015, we launched our website. And in April of 2015, we incorporated. And in May, we became an official 501c3.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you took a nap, right? That was your job was done. we exist. Yay.
Yay. And then became all the hard work of figuring out how we would bring the support that we knew was needed to the people who did it, and have been growing ever since then. We started with one little support group on what's it called, on 1-800 free conference call.
Okay, there you go.
To 7 support groups on Zoom, targeting different needs within the experience and constantly growing as the need arises to add more groups for those who would like them.
Yeah. So I know there's people like myself for whom we are career Jewish professionals. And for whatever reason, from a young age, we said, let's do that with our lives. But that was not necessarily the case for you, right? You had kind of other paths you had followed before you stumbled upon this part of your life.
Yeah, I'm a behavior therapist by training. I got my master's in applied behavior analysis and worked for 8 years in the education and parent education of students predominantly on the autism spectrum. I loved that work. But when I was going through my own journey, it became very difficult to work with other people's children. And I began to pull back a little and enjoy it a little bit less until about a year before I actually had my miracle baby. We founded Yish Tikva and became my side hustle at the beginning. It was very, for the first three to four years, we really ran as a completely volunteer organization,
right?
Which, though incredible, is very limiting in how many people you can serve and what can be done. So on that level, I was able to do it together with Ellie as something that we did fully volunteer. And almost everyone within the organization was volunteer, including all of our therapists. But in order to grow, we had to shift that model. And in 2018, in June of 2018, I quit my job as a behavior therapist and transitioned into the role of executive director at Yish Tikva. I participated in a certificate program in nonprofit management so that I would have some background. Even though my educational background was in behavior science, it would give me an understanding of the nonprofit sector.
Where did you get that certificate?
I got it through Wurzweiler, Yeshiva University's social work graduate school.
Awesome. How long was that program?
It was a year and a half.
Nice. I can assume being like, well, I'm going to switch careers, but I have no idea what to do. A little background is helpful.
It was definitely very helpful. I did that back in 2016 before actually making the big jump.
Oh, okay. In preparation for it.
Preparation for it. And since I do love participating in any type of program to help enhance my understanding and surrounding myself with individuals who are career profit sector professionals such as yourself.
Happy to be of service in any way that I can. So talk to me then about the Upstart Accelerator program. When did you start working with them?
So we started working as soon as we moved to LA. Upstart had just received a grant from the I think they got the Cutting Edge grant from the Jewish Foundation of Los Angeles, the Jewish Foundation of Los Angeles. And so they were able to offer their programming to individuals who weren't necessarily part of their network yet. So since 2016, we've had the privilege on some level to be a part of Upstart. And then in 2019, just before the pandemic, we got to be the first part of the first cohort of their sprint program. Awesome. And so through that, we learned about the Slingshot Upstart initiative to have a board member nonprofit partnership occur.
That's awesome. Awesome. So talk to me a little bit about when you signed those papers with 501c3, when you went to that training to get ready to be the executive director, what were some of your expectations when you went to start this project to where kind of you guys are now? And I'll talk about your future trajectory in a second, but I have to assume there was some mental shift about what you thought that you were building versus what's actually been created to date.
I mean, I never thought it would be this big. We were in New York. It was small in-person New York experience, and always hoped to become national. But that shift from one support group to multiple support groups, a peer network, shifting, it used to be So when we founded, we've always had two pieces to our mission. Our mission includes both direct support to individuals going through infertility, and to us, most importantly, through trained mental health professionals. And the second piece was always education. And as we've grown, what's shifted is our focus on education and how important education both is for the individual going through infertility, because an empowered consumer is the best consumer process. And it definitely, I can even attest from my own experience when I was going through it, the lack of knowledge and information essentially allowed me to become victim of the journey instead of participant in it. And as I shifted and started to have more access to education around it and learn more and become a partner with my doctor, and feel that he was able to answer my questions in that experience, it really shifts the emotional experience as well as the practical experience of an individual. So we've really shifted how we focus on education, both of the individual going through infertility and of their community at large, because at the end of the day, we could show up for them once a month in a support group and weekly with peer mentors for an hour a week. But the day-to-day really happens with your friends and family that you're surrounded with and your colleagues and coworkers. Right.
There's a lot of shame.
Yes.
I mean, you know, to varying degrees of varying, you know, people's interactions socially, it's definitely, like you were saying, when you're going through your journey, equally, it took us 3 years to get pregnant with our first child. We didn't have to go as far as IVF, but we were, you know, looking into adoption, as if foster to adopt, because it weren't sure if it was going to actually happen. And so that sort of awareness piece. I know you guys do an annual awareness Shabbat, and we'll talk about your future reproductive health stuff in a second. But, you know, and really just saying, like, it's okay to actually share this, right? You share good things, or you share broken toes, or you share, like, you know, your uncle's in the hospital, right? Like, it just sometimes can be full of shame to say, like, yeah, I had to wake up at 6 a.m. to get jabbed with a ultrasound stick and some needles, and it really sucks. And I wish I could have a kid. Like, it's, you know, it's not something that, you know, people generally open up to each other about.
Definitely. And it's also shrouded in this, in a very private part of our lives. We don't talk about our sex lives very openly in general. And, it is viewed as a failing of our sex lives. So to talk about it more openly is also a piece of it, is not just a shame. There is a privacy, of the whole experience. And it definitely adds a big piece to it. Definitely with comments like, "Oh, you sure you know what you're doing?" And just shrouded in conversation with others, around being so tied and connected to one's sex life.
Yeah. So it's awesome in terms of the resources. And again, part of the reason I jumped on your ship was really because, you know, I didn't have those resources. And as I go through my surrogacy journey, you know, I get a monthly Zoom with a group of women who are going through surrogacy, and we talk about it, right? And so even just having, you know, a group of women that you know, even on Zoom, even for an hour, even once a month, you know, with somebody who's trained to ask the right questions and guide the conversation, it just probably would have made it a lot less traumatic for myself and my family to go through having that level of support. And so I was excited to help support to make that happen. And to grow. So as big as you think it is now, it's only going to get bigger. I mean, hopefully, but
amen.
Right. So talk to me a little bit about the future, because I know we've talked about sort of the education piece and the education piece that you're looking to expand.
Yeah, definitely. We, as we were saying, that the education is such an integral piece, both as self-awareness and understanding. But at the end of the day, whether one is trying to have a child or not, we have these reproductive organs in our bodies, and understanding them and understanding how to care for them is such an important piece of living. And so little exists on reproductive health education. And so as we continue to grow, a big piece of what we would like to expand in is the education around how we speak about, how we care for our reproductive organs, as well as greater communal education and understanding around what it means to support a loved one facing a fertility journey.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What just came to mind, like, you know, vitamins can be like, oh, vitamin A, it's great for your eyes, and vitamin E is wonderful for your skin. Like, you don't hear like, oh, take these vitamins for your reproductive organs. Like, your uterus could really love some blah, blah. Yeah, no, not part of the conversation.
And so much comes up that we recently had a event in which an REI reproductive endocrinologist was speaking about how important it is. We think that being anovulatory, especially when we're not trying to have kids, is a blessing, and explaining how it actually increases your risk for different cancers relating to your reproductive organs, and how important it is that even though you might not need birth control to prevent pregnancy during that time, being on those hormones actually create for your body the hormones that your body would have naturally been producing to protect you and decrease your chance of cancer. Right. And just things like that no one's really teaching us or explaining to us, which is just so important to have that knowledge so that we can make educated decisions in our health care.
Yeah. I'd say I blame my birth control. I'll do that. I definitely think I blame my birth control. But you were talking about the education and expanding. I mean, what else is sort of the vision? What is the, you know, in 5-10 years we will be? Is it just serving more people? Is it just having your name out, having more educational programs? What's the vision, I guess, short and long term, right?
All of the above. I think that the more, as we grow, the goal is that we are a resource to everyone, both the 1 in 6 and the 5 in 6. Part of the big growth program for us is really to support those who are supporting their loved ones in struggle and creating resources to help them. It's really hard to sit with someone else in their pain. Mm-hmm. It is really hard to have empathy when our natural reaction as humans is to want to fix things for people, and be able to take that step back and say, it's okay to sit with you in your pain. So our big picture goal would be to have created a education that everyone has access to, and created resources and education around the emotional support and understanding of how to sit with someone else in their experience and support them through it.
Right. That's great. So coming back to all fantastic, let's do it. I'm in. So let's come back to you for a little bit and talk about, you know, your journey and where you are now, but also like, what advice would you have for somebody who like has a side hustle, they think it could be a thing, you know, or they like just have a really great idea and they're like, I don't even know, like got a good job and, you know, my routine is working and I know what I'm so expected of me. What advice might you have for people who are wanting to kind of take that leap and make that journey of creating something new?
Firstly, wow. It is such an amazing, it's such an amazing ability to be able to see what's lacking in the community and say, I'm going to not only try to create something for myself, but create it for others. So that would be my first reaction. My second reaction is, be mindful of what you're getting yourself into. It is a lot of work. It is really hard. It is not just setting yourself up as a 501c3. It's a process of sustaining and growing. So if there are other organizations in your space that you potentially could partner with and create what you are looking to create, I definitely, in hindsight,
right.
Definitely the advice I would give is that before jumping to become a new entity, seeing if there are partnerships that are that could be created within that space.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's plenty of things that grow big enough that they get, you know, peeled off into their own thing. But those resources are definitely there for a reason.
Yeah. And obviously, if there are no organizations that one could partner with, and this is something that you would like to see through, keeping it as a side hustle, we'll keep it small. But if it's something that you're willing to put your everything into, go for it.
Awesome. And so now you are officially deemed a Jewish professional. You're welcome. How is it what you expected? Was it different that, you know, obviously it's going to be different working in the Jewish community than, you know, your previous communities you had worked in. Again, is it like exactly what you expected? Is it harder to get connected with people and make things grow? Is it, you know, a plus or a minus that you created a Jewish organization as opposed to just a regular support organization. I'm curious to hear from somebody who came into this work, you know, how that's been going.
It's very different than I thought it would be. I definitely thought it would be a lot easier. It's a very competitive sector, the nonprofit sector. It's treated as different than the for-profit sector. But so many of the principles of the for-profit sector apply in the nonprofit sector. And part of what makes it that much harder is that we're still in a space where treating it as such is taboo. Words like overhead are considered bad words, as opposed to the reality that in order to make a successful organization that reaches more people, that supports more people, you need staff.
Right.
And that staff needs to live. And you need to pay them to live.
Right.
If not, they will move on to the for-profit sector.
And provide an environment that's a little bit more we care about you than not. Right. Like it means also means a holiday lunch. And you know, I mean, I'm sure for profit too, but you know, people it's money and it's the experience they get working, you know, with that nonprofit to be able to feel the good warm fuzzies that you're supposed to feel when you're working for a nonprofit, even if the pay is, you know, a little bit less, but yeah, paying them a livable wage and creating a successful environment for them.
Yes, it's definitely a lot harder than I thought it would be. And to be very honest, fundraising is not my happy place. I love the programming. I love the communal engagement. I love building the relationship. But taking that next step and having to ask people to financially support what you're doing is a very different space than when you have a fee for service.
So yes, definitely.
When I had a fee-for-service employment, it was very easy to say, listen, I provided you with this resource. This is how much the resource costs. No problem. But the fundraising piece of it definitely was a lot more than I anticipated it would be, and a lot more complicated because at the end of the day, money is a commodity no matter how much you have of it. And when you ask them to separate from that commodity, it's difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's hard when you don't have a board where you're like have a $5,000 give or get. You're just like, oh, everyone give me $5,000.
No, definitely. It would, it makes a difference. But at the end of the day, there is something so beautiful to knowing that you're making an impact in someone else's life. And the messages that we get about that impact is what keeps all of us going.
Awesome. So speaking of keeping going, you now have a family, you have children, your husband, I know, has a pretty demanding job as well. What are some of your techniques? What are some of your ways that you keep a balance, keep it together, keep everything, all the trains running on time, anytime that you, you know, take for yourself?
I'm not sure I yet have that part figured out. I think I'm living in the overwhelm right now.
Oh, good.
Too many things.
Stay overwhelmed.
Yes. I think the most important piece is what you said at the very end is that needing to figure out how to take time for yourself. I was speaking with someone recently and they shared a very good piece of advice. The person was explaining that what allows all of this to stay in balance is that you're getting essentially as much as you're giving. And that doesn't mean that it's not like a quid, I'm not even going to try. It's not that what you are offering is tantamount to what you're getting back, but the level of fulfillment that you feel allows you to not feel burnt out. And it's when you're giving more of yourself than you're taking to fulfill your needs is when you, I don't know why I'm having
No, you are human and sometimes words are hard to get out.
But essentially what this person was explaining is that when you feel that sense of overwhelm, it's because you're not getting back for yourself.
I hear you.
That level of fulfillment that you need. And part of that is taking a step back and saying, I need to make time for myself and I need to have self-care so that I can come back and give more.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's true in relationships. It's probably true mostly with your kids when you're like, all right, you're too much for me. I gotta take a step back. Having a conversation with your spouse, you know, there seems to be more sadness and frustration and upsetness than, you know, joy and togetherness. And so I think that's definitely trying to find that in your day-to-day job. It's when things are out of balance that it gets hard.
Yeah. And I think that that's such an important piece that you're saying, is that even for those of us who've struggled, or especially for those of us who've struggled to make it into parenthood, being able to give ourselves the grace to say that, yes, I am grateful that today I am a parent, and no matter who I am, parenting is hard. And it is okay to feel both love and tremendous gratitude to be a parent while feeling completely overwhelmed and deeply in need for some quiet time.
Yes. As I might've mentioned earlier, I broke my toe and I had to put the kids to sleep last night by myself. And they were not children. They were little demons. And I'm like, what is happening? I'm like, you know, I can't move and you're taking advantage of it. So it was a fun night, but yeah, you know, but luckily I get to have two children in my life, and, you know, might've taken us 3 years to start that journey. But I know there's people that end that journey without having, you know, children that have to go other routes. So what are some of your thoughts about reaching more audiences? I mean, you know, in terms of whoever this happens to reach, I'm like, give money to Yeshig, though. We'll put it in the show notes. But I mean, what's also nice about your model is, you, not that you naturally have donors in the people that you serve, but you kind of do, right? If somebody is going through this journey and they do end up getting, you know, having a child and they're no longer in need of your services, you know, those are potential donors. And so it's a better model than maybe somewhere that's never going to be the case. Yeah. So just curious to hear sort of more about that.
We've been blessed that as people learn about us and understand the need for an organization to support individuals facing infertility, and as they understand the need to themselves become more educated about a fertility journey, or in the process of being grateful for a child that they didn't struggle to have, that as learn about us, so many individuals make the choice of their own to come and support us. And a big part of what's allowed us to sustain over the last 9 years is just the generosity of individuals who understand and believe in the need for us to exist.
Right.
Which has been incredible. It is inspiring to see that. And the messaging and that people make, both in honor of the birth of a child, of a grandchild, or in the hopes of a friend having a child, the gifts that people make to this organization.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Quite beautiful. So what's the easiest way that somebody or a congregation or a group of people might be able to get involved when it comes to sort of raising awareness and comfort level inclusivity about infertility?
Infertility Awareness Shabbat is definitely the first step. We host it once a year. It's the Shabbat before, two Shabbatot before Pesach. And the reason that we chose it to be that time of year is that all Jewish holidays and rituals are very family focused. But more than anything, Pesach focuses on the concept of passing down this generation to generation. And in so doing, it could be very alienating for individuals who don't have those children to pass a story down to. And whether they're sitting at a table with loved ones who do have children, or they're sitting home alone because that's just too overwhelming.
Painful.
Yeah. This holiday and the messaging that exists around it is so family centered. And there's no Jewish ritual or literature, liturgy around supporting those in struggle. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it is so naturally inserted into our narrative because we have Torah portions that focus on fertility. Around Pesach, there isn't the balance of a portion that's focusing on fertility to bring it up in conversation. So we chose that time of year to be our main focus of when we bring the fertility awareness away from Yesh Tikva and directly into the community. And the idea behind it is that the communities take ownership of it. We give them the tools, but we want them to own the narrative of how they support their 1 in 6. And so Infertility Awareness Shabbat is definitely the first place, as well as reciting the fertility prayer as a community, whether it is weekly, every Shabbat, or finding very child-focused times, like at a life cycle event that focuses on children, of taking a step back and saying, at the height of our celebration of family growth, we want to take a minute and make space for those who dream of joining us in these celebrations and pray for them that they too are blessed to one day celebrate their own life cycle.
I love that. That's so easy. Come on, everybody. So easy. I mean, we shift our mindsets all the time when it comes to, you know, the way we talk about things, especially for us in the Jewish community specifically. There are really heightened times, and, you know, our spiritual leaders should be able to sort of see and acknowledge that in, you know, in their community. And maybe they have nobody who doesn't have kids, or, you know, maybe there was somebody in your audience that couldn't get pregnant, that, you know, maybe they are a single older person who's involved, but you don't know their story and what, you know, might have happened before to that person. And so that's it's really great verbiage. It's sort of great suggestions.
And it's the yes and, that which is the most important piece. We're never going to ask someone to say, please don't talk about children.
Right.
That's firstly unrealistic, and also not what we want. It's always been a yes and model. Yes, celebrate children. We are a culture that thrives on bringing down what we believe into the next generation so that they can carry on the torch. And we need to make space for those who are dreaming of joining that and supporting them in their experiences. So while at the height of our celebrations of children, we need to always remember to make space for those in struggle. And it happens to be that our focus is on fertility, but there's so many other struggles. And this concept of yes and can apply in so many different spheres of making space for those in struggle. And we don't recommend it limited only to the fertility experience. Just that's our area of focus.
Awesome. So if you don't have any money in your pocket, go to your local community and ask them about incorporating Fertility Awareness Shabbat. Again, I'll put a link in the show notes for people. But there's always some way of helping, whether you've gone through this journey, you know someone who's gone through this journey, you don't know anybody who's gone through this journey, but you know the journey. It involves a lot of poking. That's all I gotta say. If you just want to be poked a lot for a few months, that's, you know, you can have sympathy for anyone going through this process on a physical sense, and obviously on a spiritual and emotional sense, what that, you know, might feel like for somebody to go through. So lots of really wonderful resources. And so, Gila, is there anything else that we didn't cover that's on your mind about your work and why you love doing it and how excited I am to help you to do it and move towards that goal of just making sure everybody knows, you know, not only the name of the organization for its own sake, but to really reach people who are going through this, who will be going through this, who've gone through this, to have the support they deserve and that you'd expect the Jewish community to be able to provide to them.
Definitely. And I think that the reality is that the more we speak about this, whether it is in narrative of a single person story or big picture, infertility exists, and normalizing it and claiming the shame, as Brené Brown explains, the less shameful the struggle is and the more matter of fact it becomes. It's a reality.
Right.
At the moment, according to the World Health Organization, 1 in 6 couples will struggle with infertility. And that number is staggering. It keeps increasing. We went from 1 in 8 to this new statistic this past April in 1 in 6. And the reality is that the more that we can just own that it happens, the more support we can give and receive. Because as long as we don't speak about it because it's shameful, and it doesn't mean that we need to speak about it and share details with everyone, there's still an element of privacy that everyone deserves to have.
Right.
It's the secrecy that hopefully we can eradicate, in that it doesn't need to be something that is secret, but rather I am struggling. I don't want to share details, but it is a reality and it does exist. And there are 1 in 6 other people who are going through this, which means I'm no longer just a one who's going through it, but I'm a 1 in 6, which makes a community very large of individuals that I can both lean on who are currently going through it, and those who are on the other end of their journey, as well as hopefully a 5 in 6 who are learning how to show up in the most supportive manner for their 1 in 6 within their lives.
Right. And it makes me think too, you know, this might seem offhanded, I'm not quite sure, but I mean, synagogues are kind of always looking for younger members, right? And there's only a few who actually want to walk through a synagogue's doors without children. But for those that are going through that, to walk through a space and see that there is something that is friendly to Jewish fertility, whether it's their own journey or a friend's journey, you got 1 in 6. I mean, people know people, or they know, and they just don't know that they know people. But it's definitely a way to be warm and welcoming to that cohort of people that I think synagogues really struggle with attracting and finding how we show up for them. Why would they want to walk through our doors? But when they do, there's a lot of things, but this is definitely one of them in terms of, being really grounded to what their experience is right now and how a spiritual community could serve them.
Yeah, definitely. It's changing the narrative and how we invite people in. When we invite people in only as a family unit with children, and our programming is exclusively based on programs with childcare, then the narrative that we're sending is that those are the people we want to attract. Right. But when we have different kinds of programming, both programming for families and programming for individuals who are single and programming for couples who are together, then we change that narrative and we say, you're all welcome here. Not everything is for everyone, but we need to have something for everyone.
Right. That's awesome. All right, Gila, well, send me some brochures for my synagogue table so that I have them here. We can make sure that we're supporting. And all this time I haven't asked. It's crazy. But thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for telling your story and sharing your leadership journey. Welcome to the tribe of Jewish professionals. I think you're going to like it, as hard as it can be. But just really excited that we got connected and was so excited to have you on this program. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was amazing. I always love speaking with you, and this was awesome. So thank you.
Liked this episode? Have a comment or a great suggestion for our next interview? Contact us through our website at itswhoyouknowthepodcast.com or on the It's Who You Know Facebook page. As always, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast so that others can find us. It's Who You Know, the podcast.